Okay, lots of ground to cover now with Charles Seif. You know, we've talked about proofiness, how they manipulate numbers to try to get their own little point across, their own agenda. We've talked about fusion energy, and we, of course, continue to talk about decoding the universe as well. So lots to talk about. We'll be back with your questions on Coast to Coast AM. Charles, you were citing the case of OJ and how the prosecutors were using numbers. Go ahead.
Yes. The prosecutor said that there was only a 1 in 1,000 chance that someone who had hit his wife was going to murder her. And so that 1 in 1,000 looked like a very small probability, but it was taken out of context. There was a very, very small chance that someone would be murdered in the first place. And if that person is murdered, it's very strongly likely that the person who murdered the person, the person who murdered the victim had already assaulted. So the 1 in 1,000 seems small out of context. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the overarching probability of getting murdered, it's even smaller. And when you take the numbers in the proper context, it's even better than 50-50 odds. That if someone had been beaten by a spouse, that the person is murdered by that spouse.
Good point. Good point. See how numbers fudge?
Yep, and that's called the prosecutor's fallacy. And as a result, lots of people are walking the streets and a few people are put in prison.
Are we, by the human nature of our own being, are we created this way to fudge about numbers?
Yeah, I think that people learn to tell the truth rather than they learn to lie. That I think honesty is something of an acquired characteristic that we are taught. I think we're innately liars on some level. And because numbers are so powerful, I think we all gravitate towards them to lie on some level if we can.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go to the international line. Charlie in Alberta, Canada. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I had a question about, actually just really wanted to talk to you about the nature of infinity. And I think that the infinity, as we look at it, is usually implied as the macro sense, like the world around us. And I'm thinking maybe it's not just the world around us, but in the microscopic scale. It just keeps going on and on like this cone that gets smaller and bigger. Mm-hmm. And then the possibility that there are actually multiple infinities.
Yeah, actually, you've described something that is well-known in mathematics, that there's kind of The infinity of the large is something called the transfinite, that there are transfinite numbers, but there are also things called infinitesimal numbers, which are kind of the equivalent. As you get closer and closer to zero, you can get infinitely small. And scientists, mathematicians have defined a number, it's called 1 over omega, which is smaller than any real number, but larger than zero, smaller than any positive number, but larger than zero. It is, in some sense, infinite because it has lots of the properties of infinity, but it's infinity captured in the very, very tiny. So I think that you're dead on.
Next up, we go to Doug in St. Louis. Hey, Doug, go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, good to have you.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to take you and your guests back to the fusion topic for a moment.
Sure.
Nuclear fusion is actually very easy to achieve. You can do it on your desktop. Philo Farnsworth, the guy who invented TV, 65 years ago created a device to do nuclear fusion. It's just that the fact that his device wasn't able to achieve more than break even was the problem with his device. Just recently, that Dr. Robert Bussard was working with the U.S. Navy on a project to update that device, and just before he died, he got pretty darn close to it, and I just wanted to hear what your comment might be.
You know about this, Charles?
Yes, yes, and you're absolutely right. The fusion was achieved in the late 1950s in a lab, but just in small quantities, such small quantities that you put much more energy in getting the fusion than you get out. So it's not a good source of power. And Philo Farnsworth, the inventor of TV, did in fact come up with a really nice design for creating fusion. And it was so successful that he had to bury later portions of later versions of his experiment so he wouldn't be irradiating himself. Again, the problem is that it sucks more energy than it produces. And Boussard's has been for many, many years working on variants of the Farnsworth device. In fact, Bob Guccione, who just died, was an early backer of Boussard in the 1980s. His project back then, he called it the PETS, the Penthouse Experimental.
Did he lose on that project?
$17 million.
Because he was almost penniless when he died.
Yeah. He squandered it all. It's a shame because these are kind of visionary people. I think that Boussard was very smart, and he was working with a number of labs. The problem, I believe, with the Farnsworth designs is that there's so much loss in the atoms that don't fuse that because of the nature of the design, you're not able to get really nice focused beams. And as a result, you're pretty much doomed to lose energy. Of course, I'd be happy to be proven wrong on that.
The Sherwood, what's the Project Sherwood?
Project Sherwood was the early government secret project to create fusion in the laboratory. And it was at Princeton, it was at Los Alamos, it was at Livermore. And they tried a number of designs to create fusion. And they thought at first it was really easy. They had a couple of false readings where they thought they had it and they didn't. It took about a decade and millions of dollars to get their first even small fusion reaction. And once they did, it was they thought it was just a little bit away from making more energy than it consumed. And fortunately, they were wrong. If they were right, the world would be a very different place.
Bill is in Columbus, Ohio, first-time caller. Go ahead, Bill.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Charles.
Morning.
I have a question. I'm a little confused, Charles. You talk a lot about nature, and yet you said later on that you didn't believe in heaven. And I was just wondering, don't you think that this was all created by, we have a creator or a God? And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on life after death.
Well, personally, I myself am an atheist, and I don't believe that there is a life after death.
Hmm.
However, I have to say that this is one of these things which I don't have any evidence one way or the other. I mean, this is based upon the belief that I don't need it to explain the universe. And for me, having a creator brings up as many problems as it solves. So,
Are you an atheist or an agnostic? There's a big difference.
Well, you can call me a hard agnostic. I would agree that if there were evidence for God, that I would be convincible. But to all intents and purposes, I'm an atheist because I don't believe that evidence exists, and I would wager quite a bit that evidence is not forthcoming. But good point. I would say that I'm far on the agnostic scale.
Right. I would agree with that. Just listening to you. So you think when you die, that's it, curtains?
I think that it's curtains, and unfortunately, it's not a very satisfying or comforting thought. I mean, this is one of the things that I do envy people who do believe in God and in an afterlife, because that is something to look for. That is something to look forward to rather than emptiness. Of course, some people's vision of the afterlife is even more terrifying than nothingness, but to each his own.
Yet you do believe in other dimensions. You do believe in other possible multiverses.
I do. I don't have enough evidence to say that it's real or not. And I'm kind of, the questions that are questions of faith versus the questions that are backed by science. It's in some ways a matter of choice, and I try to minimize faith, but of course you always have faith in certain things. And like my suspicion that there is multiverses is a matter of faith. So,
but no, you know, but no faith on God. You're a little selective there.
That's true. And in some ways it's kind of it seems somewhat contradictory that you can have faith in one thing and not faith in another. But I think that my faith in multiverses is extremely shallow. That I would be convinced by an experiment tomorrow, if one were possible, that it's not there. The fact that there's one scientist at MIT who came up with one experiment that could prove or disprove one idea of multiverses. The problem is it involves what's called quantum suicide. And you take a quantum triggered gun and you pull it to your head, put it to your head and you pull the trigger. And you do it over and over and over again. If you survive, you're in a multiverse. If you die, there's no multiverse.
Not sure I'd want to go through that one.
No, definitely not. But I asked him, if he had a terminal disease and he knew he was going to die very shortly, would he do the experiment? And he said, absolutely, he would.
All right, let's go to Wilmington, Delaware, east of the Rockies. Hello, Robert.
Hey, George. Actually, George, I called you about this parallel universe one time. I had a dream about I went back and see my father, but he was my uncle, and my mother was my mother, but I had a brother-in-law. So my question basically is, if you have one soul, how can you be in another universe at the same time as this one? You see my question?
Well, I'm not sure Charles believes in souls, but...
Well, you're here, right? So you have to have a soul.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't believe in soul. I don't believe that there's anything more to consciousness than the vast wet stuff in our brains. But, you know, I mean, that's a good question. If you do believe in souls, the multiverse does pose a problem for you. Unless you believe that a soul can span multiverse, that there are multiple consciousnesses that all share the same soul, then... a belief in the soul would mean that you probably cannot believe in this, in the at least the quantum version of the multiverse. So, I mean, that's a very good point. And if in fact that faith is your guidance on this, then you probably do have to reject the idea of multiverses.
What is your take, Charles, on just why we're here? I mean, that's got to be one of the toughest questions for anybody to answer.
Yeah, it's one that I don't feel equipped to answer, because it's the question of why implies in some ways an intent, and intent means that there's some consciousness responsible. And if I don't believe in the consciousness, I'm not sure that I can say that there's an intent. Again, this is not a satisfying philosophy. It's not a good answer, but I think we're an accident in the sense that the universe, came to be, and the conditions were right to create life, and we just happen to exist because of that. And in some ways, I think that there's you can turn to the anthropic principle and say that, you know, if the universe weren't the way it is, then we wouldn't be here discussing it. We wouldn't be here thinking about it. So the fact that we're thinking about it kind of presupposes that we're here. But again, you know, this is not satisfying. That's one of the questions that I think is troubling mankind since its beginning. This is one question which I'm pretty sure we're never going to get an answer to.
You might be right. Next up, let's go to Wildcard Line. Scott in Gridley, California. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Hi. You guys are talking about so many things, it's hard to ask you questions. Talking about fuel and then religion. I think I'm more of an agnostic, because I haven't seen really evidence of an intelligent God, unless you want to call God creation. But I'm curious, because I'm also a theorist. I'm curious about a couple things. One of them is, I wonder if this thing called humanity is going to actually win in the end, the concept of it, versus religion. And then also, I wanted to ask you, do you think God, if God was real, could God and science be one and the same? Because, I mean, you have to have a science to creating things, and so God would use that to create things. And then I had one question I wanted to ask you. I've heard of Ford making cars that get like 75 or more miles to the gallon, but they don't sell them here because they're actually clean diesel engines. And I wonder, is it possible that we'd be better off with a, let's say, a biodiesel flex fuel hybrid car, to where not only are we getting off the dependence of just foreign oil and have different kinds of pollution so we can spread our risk better as far as pollution, but we could also help poor nations create fuel themselves, because we all know about algae oil and seed oil and other type of things. Wouldn't it be better for the United States to think about, mandating or creating that kind of engine versus just the petrol engine? And I could ask you a billion other questions because I have ADD, but I'll leave it at that.
That's right. Let's go one at a time, though. Go ahead, Charles. Let's talk about the engine first.
Okay. I guess going backwards, I do think that a lot more money should be spent in looking at these alternative devices, alternative engines, alternative fuels. They're not sexy science, and the Department of Energy hasn't put a huge amount of money in it. But I absolutely agree that it would be a great idea to broaden our portfolio so that it would reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Biofuels do have a problem in that I believe that their sulfur content is high, and as a result, you do get different types of pollution. You get sulfur dioxides, and also you'd have to ramp up production. But I do think that's a good idea. I also think that we do need to get the electricity sector working. We have to figure out how to generate electricity on the grid in a good way.
We need a new grid.
Absolutely. We need a new grid that's more efficient. There's lots of little things, I think, that will help us rather than the one big thing, which is so far away. And that's, I think, the short-sightedness of some of the fusion research. I guess turning to the God question, absolutely. I think that if there were God, there's absolutely no reason to think why it wouldn't work through the laws of science. I mean, the idea of science as the writing of God is a trope that, I mean, this is something that everyone talked about. Einstein talked about kind of seeing the hand of God. Hawking talks about seeing the hand of God. The idea of logos, the Greek word logos, means word, as in the word of God. It also means rationality. Ratio as in the word meaning for the order of the universe. So the idea is that God is order, God is rationality, and in some ways the way we understand order of the universe is through science. So there need not be a contradiction between science and God, at least in my opinion.
Charles, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take final phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Great questions. Charles Seif, our special guest tonight, whose website is charlesseif.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And so on our next Coast to Coast program, Friday into Saturday, it's Full Moon Friday. You know what that means. Anything can happen, so stand by for that one. And when we come back in just a moment, we'll wrap up with final phone calls with Charles Seif right here on Coast to Coast AM. Charles, text message in from Carl in Florida. Just wants to know if you know about the Shroud of Turin, and if so, how do you explain that?
I know a little bit about the Shroud of Turin, and the image, it seems pretty convincing, but you know, this, if you look very carefully at it, it doesn't seem to be an image that could be precisely matched to something resting on somebody's face. The proportions are slightly wrong. So, in my mind, I mean, it seems like something which is designed at a later date and meant to look like a shroud. And in fact, at this time, there were many, many relics which were circulating, which were fakes. So I'm not sure that this is different. I don't see any good evidence to the contrary, but you know, maybe it was the shroud that rested on Jesus, but I don't think that there's very good evidence for it.
Back to the phones we go, the state of Washington. It's Jim's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Jim. Go on. You're on with Charles.
Hey, how's it going, gentlemen?
Okay, good.
I actually have a question. I know everything turned kind of metaphysical towards the latter questions, but I like to get back to the elections. And it seems to me that throughout democratic societies throughout history always seem to have some issue with free elections. And we've gone through some of the pitfalls this evening, but I was wondering, in your opinion, what do you think the best way for a democratic society with a large population would be to fairly get votes?
Good question. You know, I think that in the abstract, voting can be made reasonably fair. There's actually a mathematical theorem known as Arrow's theorem that says it can't be perfectly fair. There are, in any election, there are certain elements that conspire to prevent an election from being perfectly fair. That you can look at the same data, the same votes, and argue that different people should have won, and each argument is valid. But that aside, I think that elections in general have been performed reasonably well since Athenian democracy. And the cases where an election is really gamed tend to be the minority. But as we get more sophisticated, it's easier and easier to game them. And the counting of votes, it isn't so much of a problem when you're counting a few hundred votes. And but when we have 300 million people in this country and a vast portion of them are able to vote, then counting hundreds of millions of votes means that you've got a counting problem. Electronic voting has the potential for being really great and helping get rid of counting errors. But unfortunately, the software is a little buggy at this point. Until we work out all those bugs, you know, I'm afraid that right now voting is something that is mostly good but can be manipulated.
They've always been manipulated, haven't they, Charles? I mean, since the beginning of time, since we've been doing votes, since we've been voting, they've manipulated them.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, that the gaming of the system has been fairly low tech, that you stuff ballot boxes or you bribe people. With electronic voting, you have the potential for creating massive fraud across states. But yeah, I mean, gerrymandering goes back to the early 19th century. So these tricks aren't new. And they are used to rob citizens of their votes. And the question is, how can we minimize that robbing and maximize the true expression of our electoral desires? And I wish we were moving to a kind of a standardized design of machines and a more fair way of dividing up election districts to prevent gerrymandering. But it doesn't seem like we're really moving in that direction.
Josh is in Salt Lake City. Hi, Josh. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you, George, for having me.
Sure,
I just had a question for Charles, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Charles, I was wondering if you're familiar with the idea of determinism and what you thought about that, as is same person, same future. Is that true, or what do you think about that?
I know a bit about determinism. You know, it on a quantum level, you kind of say that there can't be determinism, that there are certain things which are random and have to be random. And in fact, there is a mathematical theorem out called the free will theorem that says that if a particle is indeterminate, then people are indeterminate, that if a particle has free will, people do, and vice versa. So, you know, I tend to think that on some level, we are indeterminate. But who knows? I mean, it could be that everything is already preordained. In which case, how could we have free will? How could there be anything else other than kind of the same path for the same people?
You have talked about how the wording fair, balanced, is an Achilles heel on journalism. Explain that.
Well, you know, the thing is, balance isn't always fair. A lot of what people do...
What they mean is balance to one side.
That's exactly right. It is a bias. And unfortunately, again, this plays into our predilection to take evidence that supports our pre-existing beliefs or preconceptions. And I'm afraid with the proliferation of websites and the proliferation of cable channels that we can choose to look at sources of information that never challenge us, that never change our beliefs. And that's very dangerous because, in fact, we learn, we get information, we develop as people when we are challenged, when we are presented with things that we don't necessarily agree with or things that we don't necessarily believe. Only through those things do we develop. And we as humans are more and more able to avoid that. And I'm afraid that fair and balanced means that we are winding up in our own little Fox News's or Huffington Post's and not looking elsewhere.
The World Health Organization is very good at fudging with numbers, creating pandemics when they only have several hundred cases of flus worldwide in specific instances. They've learned that art too, haven't they?
Yeah, you know, the 1976 swine flu is a particularly good example of this, that the idea of the precautionary principle in medicine, that if there's something that could go wrong and if something that could be bad, it is your job to raise the alert as much as you possibly can, unfortunately kind of does wind up leading to hype sometimes. And the press, and I'm part of this, wind up amplifying that because, you know, the panic, something that's scary, makes a good story, whereas things are normal, nothing to worry about, is won't sell as many papers. So I'm afraid that we are primed to take news and amplify it to its extreme, and things will spiral very rapidly out of control.
When Ayn Rand talked about objectivism, what did she mean?
Well, I'm not that familiar with Ayn Rand, although I do, I mean, I've read a couple of her works, but I've always kind of felt it as kind of almost a pushing of the individual and the individual rights and desires over that of society, and that the real fundamental contribution to society is done through individuals who buck societal trends. I do think that there's some truth to that, that there's a kind of an individual element that is extraordinarily important. And I mean, civil liberties are an expression of that. But at the same time, there's also kind of society that does impose things sometimes for good reason. I mean, the whole idea of science, the scientific method, is an imposition of structure from without that people don't contribute to the scientific literature willy-nilly. They have to go through training and they have to contribute in a certain way generally. And does this mean that valid contributions are ignored? Yes. But it also means that science as a whole is kept reasonably pure, that you can be fairly confident in many, many things, even though there is a lot of garbage there.
All right, next up, let's go to Billings, Montana. Hey, Russell, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Charles, are you familiar with a book called The Money Matrix of the New World Order?
I am not.
In there's a very large chapter on mathematics, and it was rather boring until it gets to the value of zero and talks about the money paradox. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with the money paradox, but I know quite a bit about zero.
Okay. I know you wrote a book on zero, so here goes. The money paradox basically says that it costs no more to print a $1 bill than it does to print a $10 bill or a $100 bill, but you increase the value simply by adding zero, and yet we are told that multiplies the value, but we're told that if you multiply anything by zero, it actually makes it zero, and there lies the paradox.
Yeah. That's interesting, because, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right. And, you know, if everyone had, if you added a zero to every bill, it would look like it has a lot more value when, in fact, nothing has changed. And devaluations of currency usually do exactly the opposite, that when you have hyperinflation, the governments will just decide to strike zeros from the currency to rein it under control, when in fact there really is no control being exerted. So that's, I mean, it's a really interesting observation. The problem with currency is that it's all kind of a measure of faith. It's a measure of your confidence in the government's ability to treat you the way you think you should be treated, that to repay its debts and to provide services. And so, you know, the moment that you look at it too hard and you lose your faith is the moment that the currency begins to collapse. So it's one of those things where you kind of have to accept the illogic of the currency if you want it to work.
Next up, east of the Rockies, it's Bob's turn. Truck driving, aren't you, Bob? Where are you, North Carolina? North Dakota?
Yes, sir. North Dakota.
All right, there you go.
Yeah, North Dakota, hauling some coal here. So, wonderful show tonight, George. Very, very cool. I'm an amateur scientist, amateur physicist, and heavy into Bible prophecy. But your guest tonight is just awesome. And, you know, I tell you, buddy, God bless you, man. You're so well-rounded and so knowledgeable in so many different areas. You said earlier that you kind of envy those of us that believe in God and Jesus Christ, that we kind of have something to look forward to when we're dead. And when you said that, I kind of thought to myself, you know, I guess it's okay to be dead and wrong, like, or dead and gone, but, man, you better hope you're not dead and wrong. But listen, I wanted to tell you something that I thought maybe the audience would get a kick out of. I kind of know the answer to it, but I thought maybe you could explain it. That, you know, when we clap our hands together or when we reach out and touch a pane of glass or something, that you're not actually really touching that object, because the atoms that make up your hands or the atoms that make up the glass, the electrons, you know how the electrons that make up the atoms, that they repel each other. So you're really not actually touching that object. Isn't that kind of cool?
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That, in fact, matter is mostly empty space. It's mostly nothing.
Exactly.
And the reason we actually feel it is because the electrons in our hand are being repelled by the electrons in whatever we're touching. The touch is really just a manifestation of electromagnetic repulsion.
Yeah,
so it's the electric force that you're feeling.
Yeah, isn't that cool? When I found out about that, that just kind of blew me away.
Hey, what's really cool here, Bob, is we are made with 13.7 billion years old stardust. Almost.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that cool? You know, and I've always thought that, you know, the whole reason behind the Earth and life on Earth and everything and the sun is basic principle. The sun is really nothing more than an incubator and incubating life on Earth to grow life and for God's purpose to grow souls, to harvest souls. You know, you always talked about it being like a harvest. So it's just everything is so cool and so integrated and so perfect and so well in line. It just screams the existence of God. But very good show. And, you know, I really like your guest tonight. And, you know, God bless you, buddy.
Well, thank you very much. Bless you, too.
13.7 billion years old. We're all the same age, Charles.
Yeah, and that point about star, I mean, it's so literally true that any element that is heavier than lithium has to be created in a star before we were alive. That anything with carbon or oxygen or nitrogen, which we're made of, was not created with the universe. It was created in a star after the universe, and that's just mind-blowing.
Josie's in Richmond, Virginia, and there you are. Go ahead, Josie.
Hi, good morning, y'all. I wanted to tell you about the election, a little story that's not as been in the news. Two stories, short ones. One of them is that I had an occasion to go to CPAC right after the 2000 election. Someone had brought up one of those voting machines so that you could see how the hanging chads were made.
Mm-hmm.
If you put one card in there, it easily, you punch it through, it's easy to do. But if you're trying to steal the election, you put in two or three cards, and then especially an older person can't push it down, or they push it down and it gets partway, and then you get the hanging and swinging chads. So that's how that happened. Now that's one thing, and these were all in the counties where the vote stealing was going on. The second thing was that the cleanup afterwards was done by non-citizens, and they did not want to be known. But they saw and reported quietly that there were bushel baskets, trash containers full of bush votes that they had disposed of. So I think that you might, and then of course there was the military that wasn't allowed to be counted, have their votes counted because their votes, their ballots didn't arrive in time, all that sort of thing. So I don't think it was a tie in Florida.
Well, there were definitely irregularities on both sides. In fact, for example, one of the military ballot cases that you were talking about, there's no question that the Gore team was fighting not to include, or Gore supporters were trying not to include those votes. Actually, the Bush team actually prevailed in court for many of those, but not all. But yes, I mean, the point is, though, that the irregularities were so great, and on both sides, that the margin was so small. Even if you include a number of votes, a couple of thousand votes, one way or the other, and you can look at the butterfly ballot as another example of problems, even a few thousand votes wouldn't be enough to distinguish the two candidates. I think that even if you manage to figure out all the irregularities and figure out maybe Bush is up by 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 votes, maybe Gore is up by 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 votes, even so, I think that's still a tie because, in fact, the counting errors were so great.
Absolutely. And, Charles Prufenis, where do you get the book?
Amazon.com has it. It's in Barnes & Noble, anywhere you want it. You pick up large books.
Good job. Makes you wonder about numbers, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're a lot dirtier than you think.
They sure are. Thank you, Charles. Charles Seif, regular guest here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget, our next program will be Full Moon Fridays. Look out. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.